At the third stroke, it will be...
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the May episode of the EUC Digest Throwdown, a monthly recording in which the host of the EUC Digest discuss the news and the events that passed on our timelines. My name is Ingmar Verheij, and for this episode, I'm your host. This episode will be available as a podcast on your favorite podcast player, but also on our YouTube channel. So don't forget to like these videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. Now, if you have not seen the April episode, then you have missed us talk about some of the results of the Digital Workspace Survey from EG Innovations, the launch of a new alliance called the Digital Workspace Ecosystem Alliance, how NetApp and Google Cloud aim to simplify digital transformation, and what the acquisition of Nuance by Microsoft could mean for user interfaces. And we wrapped up our episode with some discussions on Clubhouse and how basically the competition is trying to copy their success. Oh, and Johan and I, you know, we discussed some craft beers. These things are not on our agenda, by the way, but they do keep, you know, we keep exchanging notes. So I hope they are educational for all of you. Not going to happen this time because I don't have a beer with me. But before we start with the first topic of today, let us highlight our sponsor, Liquidware.
Liquidware provides adaptive workspace management solutions for all Windows desktops. The company products encompass all facets of management to ensure the ultimate user experience across all workspaces, physical, virtual, DAS, or in the cloud.
Thank you, Johan. So thank
That's
you for
gold,
highlighting.
Man.
That was really good.
Like, yeah.
In the first sentence, I was like, where is he going? But the rest was like spot on.
Yeah, we're getting better. We're quite good at this.
Dude, I had to overcompensate like last month's episode. That was beyond like crap.
You should do this on a button on your ATM and
Yes, I'm gonna do that
next time. Next episode, guys.
Next episode.
More sound buttons, sound bites under your buttons. Looking forward on hearing this. So, guys. It's good seeing you all again. We're actually missing one, but for those who don't know, let's see if someone finds out, because we're going to start with Eric. Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Great to be here again. After a month, I'm looking forward to this show again. So who's up next? It's quiet.
Oh, dude, that's me. Yeah, I was waiting for Yitz, but obviously he's not here. Yeah. So
Unfortunately, you have to miss Yitz this episode. He's too busy, preoccupied with other stuff.
Okay. Thanks, Yitz. So Johan here. I'm awesome. And I have a serious announcement to make. So last Friday, in a small virtual event, there was a announcement being made that I am part of the new leadership team of the Dutch VMware user group. Something I am really proud of. I've been part of, applause. Dude, I love applause.
I thought you were going all Katy Perry style with last Friday.
Oh yeah, no, sorry, dude.
I'm so far off. I'm missing the joke here.
Yeah. Oh, last Friday. Well, there was, an opening.
So many talents.
I know.
Singing is not one of them, but
you don't know half of them. There was an opening for a new leadership team in the Netherlands, and with all the work I've done with the VMware EUC TechCon, and I've been part of the VMware community for quite some while now, or quite a time now. It was time to take that organization stuff to a new level, and. We got big plans with the Dutch VMUG, so really honored to be one of the leaders. Looking forward to all that we have in store.
Congratulations, Johan.
Yeah, congrats.
Thanks, man.
Cool.
That sounds like you get a lot more work for the same old kind of thing that you do. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well,
you would know because you're in the Dutch Citrix user group.
I'm still part of the Dutch Citrix user group steering committee, and we're actually looking forward to the next few months as our country is opening up a little bit more, people getting vaccinated and herd immunity and whatnot. So, we might have an announcement or two to make in the next couple of months. So keep an eye on the socials on Twitter and LinkedIn as we're planning for the rest of the year.
Cool. Like, just a tiny add on to what I just mentioned. If you would like to know more about the Dutch VMUG, please follow the @VMUGNL Twitter account on Twitter.
Oh, more. go figure. Yeah.
Go figure.
Great to hear that there's more community, and also, you know, that there's more getting back together with all of us. And also, I guess, I mean, I'm kind of excited. It's kind of an odd statement here, but I mean, I'm among friends here. And one of the things that I'm looking for today is actually a reunion of friends. So this evening is going to be the episode of Friends the Reunion, the one where they get back together. And I can't wait to, one, watch this. It's kind of a guilty pleasure watching Friends.
But then again, as well.
There you go. And also, I'm looking forward on, you know, the country reopening so we all can get back together, hopefully in a studio. Maybe one day there will be a EUC Digest studio so we can do a proper recording in person of the showdown.
Cool. I was reading through the topics. I was like, what kind of bridge are you, mate? What? And then you said French. Okay.
Yeah, friends. I mean, we're among friends here. So I guess, you know, that would have been possible. Anyhow, with that aside, I guess this should be our start of the first topic of the day. And I'd like to start today's episode with a moment of silence, because Microsoft announced to retire Internet Explorer after more than 25 years of service. So Internet Explorer, or IE for Friends, was released to the public in 1995 and has been reinvented itself many times. And there's not a single IT professional or a consumer that I've met in my life that cannot share an anecdote about IE. IE is one of those friends everyone hangs out with, but you never really connect with. But then 20 years after IE was introduced, so 2016-ish, Microsoft introduced Edge. And with all due respect, you know, despite being a descendant from an industry veteran, its first years, Edge wasn't the friend that you want to introduce your family or colleagues. Fast forward today, Edge have reinvented itself. It's based on a robust Chromium engine these days and even includes an IE mode. That's right. It now has a dual engine advantage, as they call it, which essentially means you can choose what kind of friends you need. So it's a schizophrenic browser, essentially. Guys, the funeral of IE is on June 15, 2020. But joking aside, this is kind of a big deal, isn't it?
Well, just can I take a second? Did you say schizophrenic?
But I'm
come on,
Friendic?
Where is it? No,
what?
No, schizophrenic. Schizophrenic. You wanted to include the friends?
Friendic.
Yeah, it's good to friends. Maybe I wouldn't say IE is my biggest friend, so no, not really. But I mean, sure. I mean, Edge, at first when that was launched, it was kind of a shady product. I haven't used it lately, but since it's based on Chromium, I think it's like maybe 1 or 2 years ago that they did this. Things have moved fast, apparently, if they're now
actually moved to Edge.
On a Windows machine, I assume, or also on a Mac?
No, on a Mac. I can't stand working in Safari. Never did.
No, I'm using Chrome on Mac instead of Safari, or don't like Edge that much. But
would have worked it well, but I really liked the part that you could have those profiles in there. And I know you have those in Chrome as well, but they're more Google-based. And I really liked the profiles. That's kind of the part where...
Dude, no one likes profiles.
Roaming profiles?
So I heard these kind of mandatory these days.
The thing with the browser is that it's Jesus Christ. All right. So the thing
back to Opera with
browsers, it's an evil, it's an evil necessity, right? So everybody needs a browser, but nobody really likes them because they're not manageable, and they were like, even modern days browsers are just resource hogs. If you look at like my Mac right now, I'm consuming a shit ton of RAM and a ton of CPU just by doing this podcast. And as we're that kind of a focus on EUC, I'm wondering what you guys are seeing in adoption on Edge versus any of the other browsers and kind of the impact of that, because a browser isn't just a browser. It's so much more than that. It's, and I'm quoting Ingmar here, but it could be a workspace.
Well, I'm glad you said that because that's what I just wanted to say. I mean, it's not just a browser. It's where you launch your applications. Some modern applications, some even launch their desktops inside a browser.
Well, it's a place where you could launch your applications. Just because you can doesn't mean you should.
No, but I mean, a lot of my applications are browser-based. Even this, I mean, we're recording this in Riverside, which is a SaaS application. So, I mean, the concept of an application changes, obviously, over time. But yeah, I wonder, I mean, Edge and its adoption, I haven't seen any numbers. I haven't looked at any numbers, but I can imagine it's not where they want it to be. So how do you get rid of IE? By embedding it into Edge and say IE is no longer available. So if you have to switch back to IE because of compatibility, and that's the reason why they have it. The funny thing is we talk about launching applications inside a browser, and then the topic that always comes back for the last 20, 30 years by now is application compatibility.
Yeah.
Well, the reason IE is in there.
Honestly, isn't a browser is just a delivery methodology, right? It's just a delivery point or delivery way of you know, getting an application to the end user.
Yeah, but isn't it an application as well? It's also
Sure, but is then a an app v framework does the same thing, but just delivers traditional applications. A browser any browser could be great, but it heavily depends on the application built by the developer to make it great. So if an application sucks on an Internet Explorer browser, but it does work on an Edge browser, it basically just means it's optimized for the Edge browser instead of Internet Explorer. So by the fact that Internet Explorer sucks so much, and in my honest opinion, always have sucked that much, just is based on the fact that developers don't optimize their code for such a browser.
Or customers have applications that are not optimized for a modern browser.
But that's the same thing, right?
I guess everybody here has it's the other way around. If you have customers with legacy applications, and like Ingmar pointed out, every one of us will have a story around browser incompatibility and fiddling around with enterprise mode and whatnot. I remember one of my last projects that I did at a system integrator, which was in 2014 or so. I was migrating an application that was written in FrontPage 4, so that was written in like 98 or something. You cannot expect browsers to be backwards compatible like 20 years or so, right?
I totally forgot FrontPage.
Oh, man. So that was horrible because there was just one page of that complete web app that couldn't render normally, and you didn't have the opportunity or the possibility to be granular in which frame you wanted to be in which browser engine. So it was a horrible mess, but it was just what this customer had in terms of applications.
So, but then, I mean, just looking at the bright side of things, I think they're doing the right thing here. I mean, obviously, IE, it existed for over 20 years. Yes, we all have anecdotes. Most of them are, you know, anecdotes for a good reason. It's not because it was a good experience. But Edge, it is the modern browser. I am very happy that it's based in Chromium because I use Chrome. So this is good for Chrome. It's good for, there's more compatibility, I assume, because it's all based on the same engine, essentially. And having a backward compatible mode in there, so an IE mode, I guess it's accepting that you have not defeated the problem exists, but it's there. And actually, part of this announcement was also that Microsoft said, hey, if you have any application, whatever it is, that does not work in this new dual engine advantage mode thing in Edge, we will fix it for free. We will assign engineers and we're going to fix it for you. I think that's a bold statement. So I like that they are committed and say we're gonna kill IE. Right? It's done. It's like Netscape, was it? Like, it ended, but it was because IE came. Assuming here, they're killing IE, and I think that's good. Like, hey, okay, like when you pull the plug, even when there are still websites, web apps, maybe even quote unquote SaaS applications. I think SaaS applications are misused by too many vendors.
Prior to that was Mosaic, and after that it turned into Firefox, right? Wasn't that the path?
There's been many paths depending on which did you take the blue pill or the red pill? I mean, you now went for Edge, I went for Chrome. I think the browsers is everyone had their own path in choosing browsers. I remember IE3 that I started using IE. It's been dead friend since then. But I guess for the EUC space, let's kill IE and focus on Edge, focus on Chrome, and that's where we're going to focus on compatibility, but also on security. And I think that's a key component of browsers these days. There's a sandbox. You have to authentication is a key component in there. Profiles even is interesting. But yeah, so the funeral is next year. We have another year of IE, and then.
Let's, I definitely want something on the soundboard, John. Da, da, da,
da. Okay. We have another 12 months. By then, yeah. I assume we all have soundboards because, yeah, rabbit holes. Damn that rabbit hole.
Sorry, dudes.
Yeah. So, okay, anyhow, while we are on the topic of Microsoft, there's another topic I'd like to cover today. Microsoft, the past years, have invested a lot of resources into application delivery. And, you know, they introduced MSI in 1999, so pre-millennium, essentially to replace the EXE installations. I would say it was brought to new levels with clever use of conditional steps by Install Shield back in the days. I remember those days were fun. We actually did a podcast with Samit from Remo3 the other day. He used to work at Install Shield, and we covered that as well. Now, Microsoft introduced MSIX in 2018. That's 3 years already. Essentially with the goal to bring Win32 and Windows Store apps, so the AppX applications, into one. Compared to MSI, it's still in its infancy, still has room to grow. But what I like about MSIX is that it's more than just a container with instructions like MSI was. So it enables Microsoft to develop AppAttach. And MSIX AppAttach, I would describe it as an application layering solution that allows you to dynamically attach an application to a user session, layering, and with that separating the application from the operating system, and that makes it easier to create a golden virtual machine image. And I would say that has to be a common practice in the industry. I know not everyone still does that, but I would still say that should be a common practice. And now, the announcement now is that Microsoft GA'd the use of AppAttach in Windows Virtual Desktop. So does that mean, I mean, Microsoft solved another limitation of WVD, so they're making good steps. And why should customers use other app layering solutions when they can use AppAttach? Because that's now a native capability in Windows 10.
What license is required for app layering or for AppAttach? That's one of the things I'm strongly wondering, because it used to be, if you look at, for instance, AppV support in a Windows operating system, you need to have Windows 10 Enterprise to be able to use that. And if customers want to, you know, use a BYOD strategy and support end users to use something like this as well, that's going to be difficult. And I know they GA'd it in WVD, but I'm guessing that this isn't just a WVD offering.
No. So AppAttach was already GA.
Yeah.
So the announcement is that AppAttach is now GA in WVD. I would assume this is based on FSLogix technology, but that's my assumption. I should have checked this. licensing...
But the question you ask is, why would you choose this over a different layering
technology?
I think it totally depends on what you're currently using already, right? So yeah. WVD is not something that you're going to put your whole enterprise in. I'm guessing
if your app layering solution works on WVD, why should you invest
That was the point that I'm trying to make.
Okay.
Let's assume, and I've unchecked, so let's do an assumption here, and based on that, let's have a discussion. Let's assume that those customers who can virtualize their Windows 10 desktop, WVD, VMware, Citrix, whatever delivery mechanism you're going to use, they have an entitlement for AppAttach, MSIX and AppAttach. Then you have a native capability of Windows 10. Why should you not use it? Because you've invested in it, right? So I wouldn't say it's free. It came with the package. You already paid for it. Same goes for Everlogix for enabling OneDrive, all the other capabilities. Hey, you have it's there. You paid for it. Why not use it?
As an enterprise, you don't want to invest in another installation method or a distribution methodology. It if you currently already have something that works for the rest of the estate, the desktop estate, could be physical, could be virtual, could be other cloud desktops. Why would you introduce something new that causes for additional administrative overhead? Applications by itself are always the issue when talking TCO, when talking return of investment, and introducing just another layering technology, albeit one that's fully supported with Microsoft and has a great future, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. You're introducing another point solution to deliver an application to an end user.
But that's assuming there's an incumbent. Hey, VMware already has an implementation. Hey, there's already Citrix implementation, whatever application layering technology is. What if it's Greenfield?
It's a good question.
Let me add another angle here, because I think that that we're assuming right here that every app vendor that's out there will support MSIX and AppAttach. And as long as there's not a broad adoption on the vendor side of delivering applications in this format, I don't see this going anywhere anytime soon. So if we look at just AppV, right? AppV has been, Softricity has been around for like gazillion
20 years.
At least. And there's still a lot of applications.
20 years?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
SaltGrid.
Yeah, it was built by Softricity.
Okay, it's been out there for ages right now, and there's still a lot of application vendors that are A, not aware of the solution stack, and B, won't support that because it's not installed physically on the system. So as long as we're still fighting that battle in terms of legacy and whatnot, do you think that customers should adopt this new technology stack en masse because Microsoft is offering it, or should they look at complete application lifecycle management and see if this is supported by their application vendors and whatnot? I mean, that makes more sense to me than just adopting the technology because the vendor delivers it.
Oh, and I 100% agree with you on the application lifecycle management piece. I would say, I mean, even though not all vendors support MSIX yet, I see great tooling out there where they will be enabled to become an MSIX, right? So that the transition from a Win32 installer or MSI installer into MSIX should be fairly easy. Should be. I mean, the theory is there. We had the pitch. But also, that enables them to use AppAttach. And I wonder, I mean, if it's there, why not consider it? Explore it. Then again, what I have always seen in many, like nearly every conversation where there's a Microsoft install base, and even like throughout the years, it will be even more. Hey, I have this great solution delivered by Microsoft that has these and these like bells and whistles. I'm at least going to consider them because I already paid for it, right? So there's an app layering or an app attached solution. Why should I go to a third party? Like, even though that's now the incumbent, like in Greenfield, that's a different conversation.
Do you know why Microsoft has the biggest partner ecosystem around their solutions?
Good enough.
Do you know
strategy.
Why? Yeah, and what is that strategy? You know, if they build something, they build it like 80%.
Honestly,
and that's for Microsoft good enough, but the other 20% needs to be filled in by partners. That's why companies like Citrix, Microsoft, Citrix, VMware, Nutanix, Liquidware all exist because Microsoft offers a great solution, but you need a partner ecosystem to actually make it enterprise ready, to manage it, to bring the best user experience to the enterprise.
So here's my thought on that. I mean, so what they've done very well is they have a partner ecosystem and they have provided a base capability where you can bolt on capabilities provided by third parties like their partners. What they do is they fill the gap. So they reach those customers which are overserved with solutions in the market. Whenever they're successful, they will fill that gap with a good enough solution, right? So they're basically reaching those customers which have, say, I don't need all the bells and whistles. Maybe I do, but I'm not ready to accept that I need the bells and whistles. And that's why you saw a OneDrive. That's why you saw an Intune. That's why you saw Office 365 come in. This is why a WVD came in and is, in quote unquote, successful. It's adopted. Depends on how you measure. When are you successful? And sure, hey, dear customer, if this does not provide you with the right value that you need today, look at the great partners. But by the way, in 6 months, look at the awesome stuff that we're building. You don't need us. You don't need them anymore. So sure, they have like the biggest partner ecosystem out there. And that's one, it's very clever by Microsoft because, hey, if they can provide it, still use our service and then use the bolt-on service. And all the way around is... As a third party, as being the partner of Microsoft, hey, if you're not partnering with Microsoft, then there's someone else who will bolt onto Microsoft. Microsoft is not a question; it's a forced marriage. You will marry Microsoft. You will have a Microsoft solution. You will use Windows. Office 365 is a choice, but yeah, let's say the majority does use it. So then, as a partner ecosystem, hey, you don't have to. Like integrate, but then someone else will.
Yeah, maybe. I think it's more or less, if the way I look at it, let's do the comparison with cars. They just built the frame, the car, and everything in it. If you want some luxury in it, there are other brands who will do that for you. We just about the basic need of a car, which is transportation. So,
what if they build the road? Okay, this is getting too far.
Yeah,
let's not go too far into analogies. Okay, let's just move on to another big name in the industry. We kind of skipped this last month. Dell. It was 2016.
Officially, it's called Dell Technologies, by the way.
Just saying.
Dell Technology, Dell for friends, but okay, let's say Dell Technologies. It was 2016 when Dell Technologies did one of the biggest acquisitions in the industry by acquiring EMC for $67 billion.
Exactly. Cha-ching!
Ka-ching. We're missing a soundbite here. 67, okay? As a part of that acquisition, Dell became the biggest shareholder of VMware with roughly 80% of the shares. So they didn't necessarily own VMware, but I mean, it remained a publicly traded company, but it kind of did because 80% is a lot. Okay, the acquisition of EMC wasn't entirely financed by Dell. They had to take on a debt of $49 billion, so that's quite a loan. It seems that Dell is now aggressively trying to reduce that debt. Last year, they sold RSA. That was $2 billion. This month, we saw the news that VMware will spin off its 80% of equity ownership of VMware, which should result in $9 billion for Dell. We also saw that Dell sold Boomi for another $4 billion. Before we talk about Boomi, which I find fascinating, what's it going to do for VMware? I mean, are their handcuffs finally off? I mean, I did saw a synergy, but then again, not really. Johan, you're the VMware fanboy here. Yeah. Come on. Dell Technologies.
Yeah. It's a, I think it's a hard marriage, and that's a case works for probably VMware's biggest competitors. And what we saw, for instance, is that Dell is a great, or was, I don't know, I didn't do any Nutanix deployments like at all, but the fact is that Dell can do a lot of things. And tying yourself to a single hypervisor makes it hard to compete to or to, you know, to yeah, to basically compete or to.
You're locking yourself down into one solution.
Yeah, and that's definitely not what you want to do if you're strictly focusing on hardware or mainly focusing on hardware. Now, from another perspective, I strongly believe that VMware's future is not tied to hardware or to the local data center. I strongly believe that VMware's future is more or less tied to integrating with, for instance, hyperscalers, delivering the digital workspace. And that loosens yourself from the hardware side of things. So from that perspective, I think it's a really great opportunity for VMware to determine their own future and stay away from and becoming a true software company. They already were one, but now being autonomous.
Truly only the workspace? They also have
everything.
Tensu. Yeah.
No, everything.
You said you focus on the workspace, but I
No. I named a couple of things like managing hyperscalers or delivering any type of application to any type of cloud. It could be on-prem, could be hyperscaler, could be something else.
But all software defined.
Yeah, call it what you want to call it, but yeah, I think that's a great strategy. But honestly, if you look at my personal idea of what's going to happen, I won't be surprised if VMware would be bought by another company. I don't have any inside information. This is just a gut feeling. But Pat Gelsinger is still in the VMware board of directors or in the shareholder board, I think. I won't be surprised if Intel would take his wallet and buy VMware in, I don't know, half a year from now. But that's just a gut feeling. It's assumption. It's.
I know we had the same talk around Frame like a couple of years ago, and we all know what there happened.
No, but that's
what the synergies. I mean, with Intel and VMware. I mean, obviously with the hypervisor there's a synergy, but then again, VMware is multi-cloud. I mean, even AWS acquiring them, maybe, but even for them, I mean, why should they? Maybe for AWS iPost making that successful, could be. I don't think so. But hey, let's see.
I don't think that AWS needs all the bells and whistles that would come along with an acquisition of VMware, to be honest. And if I look at Intel, they're getting the business that VMware delivers already. So what would be the added value of Intel buying VMware? Like it makes sense that VMware might get bought by somebody, but I don't think it would be Intel. And as a whole, I think Dell spinning off VMware will kind of kick VMware a little bit back into that innovation mode. More autonomy means a little bit more freedom of failing and be successful at the same time, because, you know, companies like that need to fail, but fail fast and then recover and kind of learn from that mistake and build better products. And I think that they're better off being an independent company than flying under the radar of the big brother Dell. But that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, and also because of the kind of interesting financial structure they had with Dell. 80% ownership when making more revenue. I'm not sure what the structure was, but it was. I tried to understand, and clearly I'm not clever enough on that area. But it seems like Dell is getting, I mean, yes, they're reducing their debt. That makes sense. It seems like they're more getting back into their hardware business more focus, I guess it is. And it's also, like you alluded to, Case, it's probably good for VMware, more focus on their software play instead of having the combination with hardware. Johan.
Dude, yeah, just before we continue the next topic, Jits, just ship me something.
Flowers?
No, Case should definitely recognize this. What's this?
It's
Flesh liquors.
No, it's the jar of spatulas that's always behind Jensen Wong's wall if he presents a keynote at GTC. And NVIDIA made a T-shirt out of it, and Jits just shipped me one.
Nice.
So Jits is still here. I'm glad that he's still
Thanks, Jits.
Oh, so he's driving around and shipping all those t-shirts out.
Oh,
yeah, he moved over to DHL. Did he? Didn't you get him in my
mind? You got him
so
in your
got
money,
promoted.
Yeah. All right, so okay. Anyway,
he's like the AI-driven package deploy person.
Nice. Well done.
Our substitute for drones.
Yeah.
So last episode we discussed new user interfaces. Now we're talking about modern delivery mechanisms. We should have covered this in a previous topic on app attach, being app delivery, package delivery. No.
Oh, so, I thought you were making the bridge.
Sorry, dude.
Podcast.
Okay, let's switch back to the topic where we were on Dell and VMware. So Dell selling Boomi. I mean, I guess that to me at least makes sense because Dell or Boomi already operated independent. I didn't see a synergy with Dell so much. They sold it for $4 billion to private equity. By the way, if someone's going to buy VMware, I think a private equity makes a fair chance getting it off the street and start operating independently. And we'll see what happens then. But yeah, I hope that a good return on investment. And also, Boomi is an integration platform, just like MuleSoft, Workato, maybe even Microsoft Power Automate. And integration platforms these days are booming, for sure.
I'm glad you explained, because I didn't know what Boomi was, and I felt
Did you just make that joke in my integration platforms are booming.
Boomi. There you go. Yeah, no, but I mean, integration platforms, I think we will see more. Obviously, acquisition of MuleSoft actually is already acquired by Salesforce, but still operating independently. Boomi, hey, again, doing an assumptions here, but VMware acquiring Boomi, why not? I mean, they used to be a brother and sister under the Dell family, and they did not cooperate. But let's move to that topic later on in the show, where they actually start operating together. Workato, hey, maybe they will get acquired at some point. So while we're on the topic of VMware, again, there's a lot of things happening. We already mentioned it earlier. Pat Gelsinger, he resigned as VMware CEO a while back. He went to Intel. And then VMware started a quest for a new CEO. And recently it was announced that as of June 1st, Raghuram will be the new CEO.
Raghuram.
There you go.
Raghuram.
With an annual salary of...
Rum? What?
With an annual salary of $1 million, up to 150% of annual target bonus, and some stock with target value of $8 million. Wow, that's a decent package. I can imagine people wanted that function. And Rocky is bullish about the future, and this is what he said after the announcement, and this also kind of explains what we just discussed. The fact that we're getting spun out of Dell, you can almost think of us as Switzerland of multi-cloud. That means independent. We're hardware agnostic, cloud agnostic, and we can really focus on helping our customers run their applications and run their IT however they want to run it. I do think they're in the right position to become that Switzerland of multi-cloud. I would say this is kind of forward-looking, being hardware independent and like cloud agnostic. Not too sure about that, but hey, I think this is good. It's good that their handcuffs are off and VMware can start innovating in that area again. I did not hear of Raghuram before, but I'm glad that he's now leading it.
Yeah, he was he was working at VMware for, I think, like 17, 18 years. And he is basically the architect behind the whole multi-cloud strategy. So he had massive value for everything related to their multi-cloud stuff. And I don't work at VMware. I never met the guy. I sometimes heard him like present a session or a keynote during VMworld. So I have no opinion on his leadership skills. I do know that, and that might be a bridge to probably the next topic. But I think he was like head on to Sanjay Poonen.
Mm-hmm.
And I know probably all of your opinions on Sanjay, but I truly thought of him of being a strong inspirational leader from a VMware perspective. And I was sad to hear that he was going to leave, but I think that's probably just a result, you know. For him, the next logical step was to be to become the new CEO. If that was not to come out, then yeah, then the logical step for him was to be to probably become CEO somewhere else.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, we haven't heard where he's going. I mean, yes, he was a front runner, but also, I mean, he was the man that made VMware's EUC group. He ran it. He made it into a $1 billion run rate business. So he was successful. So I don't mind him leaving. That's because I work for Citrix. Yeah. So, I mean, he's leaving. That's good. But also, what makes me wonder is if Sanjay leaves, I have not seen who's going to be the successor of Sanjay. Sean Bass for president, I'd say.
The guy who will probably be either like interim or a replacement, he came from Citrix. What was his name again?
So many people came from Citrix. I don't know which one you're
no, but he led the EUC business unit for a couple of years together with Sean.
Welcome back to this one. I wonder, I mean, besides who's going to replace Sanjay at VMware, what's it going to mean for the focus of VMware? I mean, they spun out of Dell. We have Raghu leading the company who has basically created multi-cloud at VMware. It's clear that multi-cloud is the future for VMware, as he said in his statement, and makes perfect sense, right? That's where the world is heading, so you have to. But what's it going to do for the focus of EUC at VMware?
It won't change, honestly. Raghu also led, but that's like 10, 12 years ago, I think, when VDI was still part of the data center solutions. He also led the UC stuff. But now, you know, the leadership is in hands of Sean Bass from a technical perspective. And I don't know anyone with such a big vision and head side on what's happening there. If you look at the total, you know, leadership of EUC, Brian Madden's there. You know, people like Ron Oglesby came in. I have a really, really good feeling about it. And you're seeing all sorts of stuff happening around, let's take the Alienware workspace, for instance. We're probably going to talk about later on, but and the guy that I was referring to is Sumit Dhawan.
Ah, yeah.
I think he currently took on the role of COO.
Yeah, makes sense. I mean, I think that's going to be a good success. I mean, the others that you mentioned, yes, Shaw, maybe. The others, I'm not sure if they are the successor of Sanjay.
Definitely not. People. But okay. Sumit is. Sumit Dhawan took on maybe it's a temporary role. I don't know for sure, but he took on the COO role.
Hey, Jan, just curious about your thoughts here. What I'm seeing with Nutanix and the whole multi-cloud strategy is that, and that's kind of a tie-in to Ingmar's question, I'm seeing a lot of focus around end-user computing in that multi-cloud scenario. So maybe end-user computing can drive the multi-cloud strategy within VMware because, you know, for generic server virtualization, it might be people are still toe-dipping in. Whereas desktop virtualization, they might be more comfortable in a multi-cloud scenario, so it's easier accessible to actually make that step into multi-cloud. And because of the nature of end-user computing, multiple VMs, high demanding from a CPU and RAM perspective, that might be a kind of a good lead-in into more serious activity in that multi-cloud scenario. Does that...
Well, one of the things that happened for instance, is that since the 1st of May, everyone who's now acquiring new licenses or purchasing new licenses is automatically rolled into a subscription-based licensing model called universal licenses. A universal licenses automatically entitle you to the use of Horizon Cloud on Azure, Horizon Cloud on GCP, more of those Horizon on VMC, so AWS. So the whole multi-cloud strategy has already been set set a year ago or 2 years ago, and continues to develop. So from that perspective,
any makes sense, right? I mean, the Martini effect, any device, any cloud, anything. I think it's let's see what's going to happen. I'm happy to rock you. Sad to see Sanjay leave. I mean, I'm not personally not his best friend. I've never met him in person. I've met him on Twitter, so I don't think that's the great experience. But I mean, it's good to see some movement. There's some more news from our friends at VMware, and you already alluded to it, Johan. April 20, VMware announced their Anywhere Workspace. It's said to be a solution to manage multimodal employee experience, better secure a distributed edge, and automate the workspace. Later on the same article, it says that it combines Workspace ONE, Carbon Black, and VMware SASE into a unified solution. I have read the article, all of them. I have to admit, it was a bit underwhelming to me. I mean, it's good to see that VMware now is a unified go-to-market. They call it the Anywhere Workspace. I think Ivanti had the same slogan at the same time. It was kind of confusing. But it combines the Workspace ONE and the other products. But in essence, Anywhere Workspace is very little new technology or functionality. It's a lot of rebundling and repositioning of existing. And what I like to see, but that's because of my focus and also coming back to the topic of Dell technologies, is the introduction of experience workflows based on Dell Boomi. Boomi. Again, a bit disappointed that it wasn't happened or mentioned in anywhere in the 2 days online conference that they organized around the Anywhere Workspace. I heard a lot about VMware SASE, other things, but most of the things already heard at VMworld. And also, I'm glad they did this with Dell Boomi because previously VMware had mobile flows. Man, that was ugly. It was a pig with lipstick. You're asking a customer to develop, create, and run Java scripts, and then expose them to the public internet so you can access your
Dude, it was worse. It was worse. Connectors for mobile flows, needed to be built inside spin up like Docker containers on your own IS platform, and you had to maintain them. You had to customly build them. It was beyond crap.
Is there any enterprise that says, hey, this IT admin just built a JavaScript. It's going to connect to my system of record, so my enterprise app. What CISO is going to accept that? And by the way, we're going to expose it to the public internet, maybe with an SSL certificate. But that's it. I'm sorry, but I found it ugly to watch and ugly to see that VMware did this. So, again, IPaaS, integration platform. Hey, Dell Boomi, it's one of the leading IPaaS vendors out there. Great bunch of connectors, so a lot of connections into your system of record. It has orchestration, it has automation, so it's one of the mature solutions in the market. So, hey, I'm applauding VMware for finally doing this. It's kind of, timing is just odd.
Yeah,
I mean, you're separating from Dell. Dell is selling Boomi, and now you figured it's a good time?
I honestly think that VMware wasn't allowed to buy Boomi directly from Dell.
But they can use it. I mean, you have the technology in the house.
Yeah.
Why build mobile flows?
I don't know. There must be a reason for it.
Okay, anyhow, but hey, I have a bias for you on this.
Yeah.
On VMware Anywhere Workspace. Johan, you are close to VMware. You just mentioned you're going to be the leader of the VMware, one of the leaders in the VMware of NL. So what's your thought on the Anywhere Workspace?
Well, let me start by saying that the Anywhere Workspace, yes, is a SKU. So it's a bundle of solutions, but it's not just a bundle of solutions. Actually, engineering has been done to integrate those solutions together. And the perfect example of that is that. So Carbon Black obviously is the next gen AV solution that VMware acquired 2 years ago. SASE is based on VMware's SD-WAN. Solution, so it's software defined wide area networks, and the Workspace ONE solution obviously is the digital workspace. Now, one of the things that VMware has been focusing on in the last couple of years is creating an enterprise secure environment through a consumer simple solution. Now, the issue with that is that it could become consumer simple. But implementing zero trust is something completely different. A lot of companies are strongly focusing on delivering zero trust solutions. And one of these, and I think that zero trust by itself is not a solution. It's not a product. It's a security principle. It's a security methodology. And if you Google now for zero trust, you'll probably find results on the first page of security companies delivering those solutions. Purely security companies. And one of the reasons why security initiatives commonly fail is because the end user is not, or the user, the let's call it the employee experience, doesn't have a focus within these solutions, or a tiny focus. If you look at how Google implemented BeyondCorp in 2011, they have five key principles within their zero trust delivery, or zero trust principles. And one of those key principles is bringing the best employee experience to the end user, which means that automatic enrollment of a device is part of that. Delivering a simple Chrome plugin that is either green or red means that you're either securely working on Google's internal environment or you're not. In case you are, everything is perfectly fine. In case you're not, you have to enter like self-service kind of portal to remediate the issue. Now, I think delivering zero trust only works if you put the end user on the first place. And this is why I strongly believe, but I am biased like you are, that the Anywhere Workspace is something beyond just a bundle of solutions, because it strongly focuses on delivering zero trust to the enterprise with that key great employee experience in mind.
But okay, so not to discourage or downplay anything that you just said, I think BeyondCorp from Google, they basically founded SASE, or the concept of SASE, zero trust, I should say. SASE is the subset of or superset of ZTNA, yeah. Zero Trust Network Access. The thing, VMware SASE it's a bundle, right? It's VeloCloud, SD-WAN, it's secure web access, something-ish. But you said consumer simple. One thing I have to disagree there is that consumer simple is not buy VMware SASE. Oh, and by the way, you also need to get a license at Menlo or Zscaler, because we kind of have a partner agreement and it's not an OEM. So
that's not good. That's not entirely true. So Zscaler delivers cloud services that you could use in combination with SASE, but you don't have to use them. I think if you look at the engineering work that has been done, one of the examples is the Unified Access Gateway, which VMware is trying to copy functionality from Citrix's
ADC,
and they, for some reason, some things they do a really good job. But one of the things that you see is that the Unified Access Gateway you normally use to tunnel Horizon connections now is also capable of becoming a SASE endpoint in the cloud. So it's basically just replacing your VPN entry point to the point of entry that's closest to yourself.
But that's inbound, okay? So that's the VeloCloud piece. So inbound data into your data center, but outbound, so secure up gateway, that's where Menlo or Zscaler come in. So Zscaler, ZIA or Menlo security, that's the outbound. So the
about CASB?
Exactly, same thing.
Yeah.
So CASB is secure web gateway, SWIG, as some people would like to call it, and all those capabilities come through a partnership. Don't get me wrong; these are leading vendors in the space, so it makes sense to partner with them. But it's not consumer simple in the sense like, hey, I believe in SASE and I want to go with that methodology. But then consumer simple is like, oh, by the way, it's like, you can say speak and choose. That's true, right? Like a Chinese menu. That's good. Would be nice if at some point VMware can bundle it. Let's not make this
an actual translation into English for that menu.
VMware SASE or SASE as a whole is going to take a long time. And SASE to me, it's like cloud 5 years ago. Or high school sex. You know, we all talk about it. No one's ever really done it.
Okay. But let me put it like different and not like pitch the anywhere workspace. What I do think is really important is that companies delivering great employee experience or a great form of like onboarding or self-service or whatever micro apps that could support your workday. Those are the companies who are strongly delivering on that employee experience. Those are the companies that you also need to involve, like Citrix, like Microsoft, like VMware, to deliver that zero trust to the enterprise. Yeah. Without that end user focus, those initiatives will fail for sure.
Oh, I agree.
And another question from my side. If usability or user experience or employee experience is a key factor, how can we tell that that's one of the main drivers? Is there like in the setup process, is there a way of defining that kind of key person that everything spins around, or how does that translate into the products?
Could you like rephrase that, or what's yeah, sure. the actual so question behind the question?
So if like stated, employee experience is one of the key facets of the whole strategy, how can we tell from a product perspective, where do we see that, is there like a design methodology that you can use to put employee experience at first, or is there some safeguarding into the products that help kind of maintain that employee experience while we're twisting and dialing the knobs? Well, does that make sense?
Yeah, well, I think employee experience by itself is hard to define or is hard to quantify, and we had a great discussion in the last episode with Brian Madden around that as well. I think that, you know, every customer, every organization is different. I did a lot of work for a Dutch book club, and you probably all know what book club that was. I designed their digital workspace, but most of the employees normally use a old school Nokia phone and don't have e-readers because they love like the smell and the
nostalgia,
the experience, the nostalgia of a book, of a traditional book. Such a company has different employee expectations and thus probably wants to focus on a different type of employee experience. So it's hard to quantify, but I think for every different company, it's really good to open up the conversation with your employees to see what is the current employee experience, what does it lack, and how can you improve that, you know? And one of the things there, one key metric that you can quantify is shadow IT. If your enterprise is having shadow IT, and from an IT perspective is something definitely that you don't want to know, but you do need to measure that, that's really important. The more shadow IT you have, probably the worse your employee experience is.
Yeah, and I think just like I think there's a parallel with work from home or remote.
Good question,
work.
By the way, Case.
There you go. I think just employee experience is not an IT project or IT deliverable. IT or the product can be a facilitator in improving employee experience, which is a very broad term, just like user experience. And I think with the solutions that we see coming up the last years is that the digital worker or the remote worker is more digital, need to be facilitated. So the consumerization of IT, that, you know, the consumer, the employee is in the driver's seat, that's what you see. So, you know, we're more and more facilitating an employee in making the right decision, facilitating him in getting the right information at the right time whenever they want it. So you see Microsoft Viva popping up. You see VMware coming up with experience workflows. You see Citrix coming up with a digital workspace, which include, you know, a feed and micro apps. Is that the like the holy grail? No. But I think what we also mentioned in the conversation with Brian, and we also saw other vendors doing more, is that IT, as an IT department, is more and more becoming a line of business department, or basically working together with communication teams, HR teams, like, hey, how can we facilitate you? So the movement we saw a couple of years ago with, hey, we now need to do mobility, moving mobile devices from Facility, which is just handing out the Nokias, you know, the old school Nokias, into, by the way, it's a digital platform. We need to manage it. We need to enable it. It's now a conversation with HR, which says, hey, one of the perks of working here is that you get freedom of choice of whatever device you want, whatever plan, whatever provider. And technology is the enabler that enables that great thing that HR provides to its employees. That's part of employee experience. You can choose whatever device you want. We will enable you. Do you want to use a Mac? Do you want to use Windows? Fine.
Yeah. Trends are shaping that perspective through the years.
Trends what?
The trends are shaping that perspective through the years. So those will be shaped and evolve and change during time.
Yeah, and I think it's good that vendors, IT solution vendors, realize, hey, it's employee first. Yes, IT has their. Go ahead, Case.
Well, I'm just wondering. So we talked about employee experience, and clearly we think that IT should not be responsible for delivering employee experience as a whole, nor should we be responsible for defining what user experience should be. Or employee experience should be. What, in your mind or in your vision, should be the right department to kind of define employee experience and set kind of the SLAs on what it should be? Should that be HR? Should that be the department themselves? Or Ingmar, go ahead.
It's a collaboration. It's not one. And it's not SLA, it's XLA. It's not about a service level, which is a hard metric. It's about experience. So it is a collaboration between the various departments. And it's also striking the balance, right? But so it's about...
Dudes, you all have been probably part of an IT department in some part of your career. Or either like contracted or working with an IT department. But we're transitioning from like IT-centric workspaces to user-centric workspaces, right? And still a lot of, I don't know about you guys, but still a lot of customers I talk to, their IT departments are still demanding or still deciding for end users what their workspace is looking like, what applications they get, how everything is defined. So
calling an epic failure.
Yeah, but it also means that they're still commonly known as the department of no.
Exactly.
I actually was reading an article, yesterday evening by Quartz, which done a research in 2019, in which they stated that, especially with all those digital natives and millennials coming to the workforce nowadays, that innovation and creativity and especially productivity within the workspace come also with the delivered workspace technology and the devices they can and are allowed to work on. And on an average, they were like 38% productive with average technology and average devices and all that was still managed through IT. On the other hand, they also did some research in companies where HR had a hand in these and also participated in these XLAs, what Ingmar was telling. And they had a 90% coverage on that instead of a 38. That's a major number. And still, I think labor costs is still the biggest cost aspect today within companies. So productivity and creativity and all those things like experience of your end user is a big thing.
Oh yeah. And by the way, let's wrap this up because otherwise we're going to spend hours.
Yeah, can I say one final thing, like a short thing? I think IT departments should start to focus on delivering or becoming a business partner to the organization, just like HR has been doing in the last couple of years.
Although differently, more and more we see budgets, also from research, that the budgets of spending on IT is shifting from IT departments into business departments. So it's not IT who has the budget, but instead it's business who's giving the budget to IT. So that's changing regardless. And did you know that based on research, 70% of the statistics are made up? And with that joke, let's move on to another familiar name.
I was proud of reading this article on Quartz.
There you go. So this year, Google, a name we all know, it's hard to miss, repositioned their G Suite into Google Workspace. Now, Google Workspace is more than just a rebrand. It's meant to be the digital interface into work that not only unifies Google products, but also external content. And last week at Google I.O., which is their annual developers conference, they've launched a smart canvas. So it brings the content and connections that transform collaboration into a richer, better experience in Google Workspace. What this effectively means is that users can author and collaborate on documents and use interactive building blocks. So for instance, you can now tag people in your organization with an admention, which then shows up as a smart chip, as they call it. And with that user's information, you can see who that is, where it belongs, click through and you know, find the hierarchy, whatever. You can also tag documents or meetings with smart chips. So you can basically create dynamic checklists of small projects. It's a smart canvas. It's just a canvas where you're working and you can collect all the data from other environments, which is good for employee experience. And seeing this really reminds me of a similar product called Coda, which has been successful, but not adopted across the board. It's what I see Dropbox doing with Dropbox Paper, which is a collaborative document collaboration tool. I always forget how to pronounce it. But also, and this is something which we probably will all see since Microsoft has a conference this week, I think it is, Microsoft Build. Microsoft, I think they announced Fluid, their Fluid framework at Ignite or last year. And that allows for real-time collaboration between users within the Office products. So you can now have within your Teams an object which is an Excel file or an Excel object like an Excel table. It's all very dynamic. It's all very collaborative. And I would say this is not only the future of collaboration, but it's also the future of working. So maybe Teams is my new workspace. Maybe Word or Google Docs is my new workspace.
Hey, Mark, would you say that the Google Workspace is a workspace with intelligence?
Oh, yeah, sure. I would say they have some intelligence in the background, at least in their own products, for sure.
Yeah, because it reminds me of a product from a certain vendor that has
we've talked far too much about.
No, we haven't discussed this one.
This is a different one. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think, and also think there's a similarity that they bring in pieces of data, relevant pieces of data. And I think that's the key part, right? So, I mean, it's good that you have large enterprise applications, small enterprise applications. You have small SaaS applications like Workday or Salesforce. I can hardly say they're small, right? They're kind of huge, but very focused solutions, being an ERM, being a CH or like an HRM application. I mean, you don't always have to work in that application. If I want to do a PTO request or if I want to tag a piece of that data, like a Salesforce opportunity into a document, like, hey, we're working on this project. Can you check this opportunity? Maybe a support case, which is in there. I think this is great that Google is doing this and going beyond Google products into a bigger space. And I would even say Google has a strong emphasis, a strong focus on the enterprise and really wants to, is finally starting to make a good move on Microsoft. We saw the Modern Cloud Alliance. I think we mentioned this a couple of episodes back, where they are collaborating more with alliance partners. So again, the partner ecosystem is important. But who's ready using Google Workspace?
I am. I've been working with
Google plus Itopia.
No. Before it was called Google Workspaces, like G Suite, for I don't know plus 10 years now, something. Because it used to be free.
Yeah, I know.
I had my own hosting company, website hosting company, for a long time. And all of my customers got a website hosted at one of my servers, and all of the email stuff was all handled through Google Workspaces. So I, dude, at the peak time, I think I had like 200 domains running inside Google Workspaces, all for free. So I loved it, and I still use it for most of my own domains.
But that's the hosting part. I mean, as a content creation, content authoring, content collaboration, I mean, to me, Office is the de facto standard. The times I used Google Docs, Google Sheets, whatever, like in the past, were suboptimal. It was like, hey, it's nice, but still not. It's not Microsoft like.
With what, this capability, wasn't that Google Apps prior to G Suite? Yeah.
Google Apps for Business.
For business. Oh, okay.
We still actively use it internally. So we have access to both the Google Workspace and the Microsoft Suite. And depending on who you are and who you're collaborating with, you can pick one or the other. And what I see in our organization internally is that the Google Suite seems to be a little bit more adopted by engineering, whereas the Microsoft Suite is a little bit more adopted by our sales side of things. So, you know, it might also be a case of having that right tool at the right time for the job that you're wanting to execute, right? If you want to collaborate real time, then a GDoc is really useful because I can pull the four of us in and we can start collaborating right away. No, strings attached, and we can start kicking that off. Where it might be a little bit more difficult from a Microsoft perspective. Then again, if I send out a Word document, I might have better success of a customer being able to open it than a GDoc, although there's compatibility there. You know, so it really depends on what you're trying to achieve and potentially where you're coming from a use case perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I think the collaborative piece of which we're now seeing in Google, I've been using it in Office 365. I mean, collaborating on, I don't know, PowerPoint, a Word Excel, a Word file, it works really well. At first, I didn't see this work, but it's just like magic. You can save so much time. So if we can go into more the micro segments of a document, instead of opening Word and have a document, but really work on the small piece that you actually want to collaborate on, I think that's the future of collaboration. So I'm happy to see Google pushing that, as is Microsoft. So it's going to be Battle of the Titans. Dropbox, essentially, and CUDA already, they started it. And I think they have a good install base and good customers that are leveraging it, but mostly marketing people.
CODA, not CUDA. Sorry, dude.
Potato, tomato, no, tomato,
something
whatever.
Completely different. CUDA is something completely different. Yeah.
Kudos for you. Okay. Yeah. Okay, guys, I think it's time to wrap up this episode.
No.
Oh!
Please let Kay something say about the fluent new look of the Azure icon.
that's fair. So, guys, just as before Kay starts about talking about the fluent new look of Azure icon, so what we do in preparation of every throwdown, I ask everyone, like, hey, guys, do you have topics for this episode? And as a listener, watcher, whatever you are, if you have a topic that we need to discuss, submit it. That will be fun. Kay submitted a very interesting topic, which is the fluent new look for the Azure icon.
Asking our listeners to submit a topic, and while you're asking us to give a bit of an explanation to that. So I think you also should ask our listeners to give a bit of an explanation or introduction to the topic there you are trying to submit.
Yeah, so the context here is if you submit something, like Kay did, Kay just said, yeah, Azure has a new icon. Please tell us why this is relevant for this podcast, so that when we announce this, when I read my paper, it says like, so this is interesting. Case, what are your thoughts on the new Azure icon?
Well, I mean, to be fair, I just like it when I deliver you work and you have to actually do research and I don't. So that's one of the things. But yeah, Microsoft just on May 7th. Yeah, on May 7th, they released a new icon. And I saw it on every social, right? So it was on my Twitter feed. It was on my LinkedIn. I even saw it from some weirdos on Instagram. that Azure has a new icon, and apparently people are very proud of this new icon because
it's a new icon.
It was like an official press release.
That's the Autodesk icon, right?
Yeah, dude. Let's talk about Microsoft icons in general. So Microsoft decided to deploy like Office for Mac with new icons.
Oh yeah,
my freaking OCD senses are constantly tingling because now they have like a white edge around those
Office for
icons.
Teams.
Oh, dude! So I've removed all Microsoft icons from my taskbar.
Hardest part for me was I was in a team session and I needed to present something, and they changed the piece where you could present. So I was pulled into a meeting, and then the guy said, show him the demo. And I was like, okay, great. So I started talking for 2 minutes to get the demo ready. And then I was searching for 5 minutes how to share my screen because they changed it.
But that's CI/CD something. I mean, this is constant change, right? I mean, imagine you guys. I assume you guys are clever IT professionals, so you kind of have a touch feeling with this kind of technologies. Imagine being a doctor, imagine being like a typical normal user is like, damn it, the icon changed. I remember switching from I don't know Office 2000 XP. I mean, back in the days, like, oh no, we can't do that. We need to do a user training because you know they would be afraid. Or even moving an icon on the desktop was like,
because
no,
we need to change the color from purple to pink.
Look, we need to do a communication first because the icon changed. I mean, embrace change. I think that's the message here. I mean, change is constant. Embrace change. That's going to happen. But
don't steal other people's icons.
I really want to know what Johan's trying to say because he really likes to get in there.
Oh man, I saw a tweet the other day, and you all know that about like something that has been seen cannot be unseen, right? Have you guys ever like looked really good at the Slack icon? Did you notice that the Slack icon basically is four ducks sniffing each other's asses?
Oh, dude!
Not yet, but I'm checking now.
I'm checking it.
I hate you now, Joanne.
Yeah, man. I'm going to remove Slack.
My Slack experience.
Why did you say this?
Oh, duck! It's time to wrap up this episode of the UC Digest Throwdown. Thank you all for sticking with us until the end. We had fun. We look forward to next month's session. Before we wrap up, I would like to emphasize that we obviously publish in your favorite podcast player, but also on our YouTube channel. So don't forget to like these videos and subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you happen to have a topic, we just mentioned it. If you have any topic that we should discuss, also include why we should include it and why this is relevant and why, maybe given your opinion, that would be fun, that you'd like to discuss in the next month. So that's June. Or just want to stay in touch, reach out to us on the social channels. Usually that's Twitter, or by email on podcast@eucdigest.com. Cheers, and see you next month at the next Throwdown.